is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast. It's Thursday, December 19, 2019. I'm Buster Olney, and producing back in Bristol is Troy Farkas. Troy, the last podcast of the year. What do you think?
It's a sad day. It's been a great year for the podcast. You've had a lot of fun. Had a little mid-season acquisition when that other guy left, and it's been fun. So thanks for having me this year.
Well, thanks for jumping in mid-season, taking over and doing a great job. And I expect that you kind of are actually looking for the end, looking forward to the end of the podcast for this year, because the next podcast will be about 2020 and your Rangers. There's some hope, which is kind of fun. Yesterday, I found myself thinking a lot about hair. Okay. Cause I saw the picture of Gerrit Cole go out as he started his press conference. And my initial thought, I got to tell you, cause you know that Yankee rule where you can't have any facial hair. My initial thought was, yeah, that's kind of stupid.
Yeah, like, I know.
He
didn't look comfortable out there looking like that. I like him grizzled. I like him looking like a backwoodsman. It makes him look like a much better, intimidating pitcher. I don't like it.
Yeah, and I, you know, at a time when they're talking about, you know, seeing the personality of the players and you see tattoos and you get a lot of more feel for that, and to have them have like a whole team where they don't have any hair, that seems weird to me. We're gonna ask some of our guests today about that. We'll be talking with Tyler Kepner. Hembo will join us, Alex Speer of the Boston Globe, and we'll have the last Bleacher Tweets of the Year from Rena Bonina. I mentioned the press conference. Gerrit Cole, center stage, and he explained why he wanted to be with the Yankees.
It was my dream. I had a second opportunity to chase it, and it's the best organization, in my opinion, in the league. There's a process here that Brian spoke to and that he just alluded to a couple minutes ago about trying to bring the best people at each individual position to surround everybody with the best opportunity to succeed. I think they've demonstrated that, certainly through Brian's tenure over the last two decades. So it instills a lot of confidence as a player when you hear those things, and it doesn't hurt to play for your favorite team. You know, the Yankees are on at 4 o'clock every day, so I'd rush home from school, pop the TV on outside, maybe invite a couple of my buddies over, and Tyler and Charlie, and we'd sit on the patio and watch the Yankees games. We had a wonderful opportunity to go to the 2001 World Series where I had that sign. And I think that was probably the only time the entire nation was rooting for the Yankees after the unfortunate events earlier that year. So, it's just what a franchise of tradition and success and championships, and it kind of embodies the true American dream.
Yeah, in the middle of this press conference, he pulled out a sign that he had made when he was attended the 2001 World Series in support of the Yankees. It had been in a back closet someplace, Troy. That was kind of a cool moment.
Yeah, that was really cool. You wouldn't think that, you know, I know like his parents held on to it. Gerrit didn't even know that it was still there. It's crazy some of the things that your parents hold on to, and who knows, it might come out and help you later on.
Right. And those usually get tossed out when you leave home and your parents are like, okay, go clean out your room. Take all your stuff and the rest is going down the basement. Aaron Boone, the Yankees manager, talked about how Cole will impact this team.
As excited as I am to be able to hand him the ball every fifth day, and I know a lot of people in this room, I'm sure, are looking forward to seeing that, I'm equally as excited to see what he brings behind the scenes and adding to what I feel like is a room full of guys that have a lot of championship qualities. I feel like we're a team with championship intangibles. We haven't pushed through yet, but we've clearly been knocking on the door for now a few years, and I just feel like Gerrit will be another guy that comes here and fits in. And I know there's going to be so much, obviously, in expectations. I know it's going to be a difficult journey. I know it's going to be a challenging journey, but I also know it's going to be one that he's going to find a lot of joy in. And I know he's going to love wearing this uniform and showing up to work every day with a bunch of guys that are like-minded that are really hungry to add another championship to this organization.
Yankees general manager Brian Cashman was on the Major League Baseball Network with our old friend Brian Kenny, and he talked about why they signed Gerrit Cole for 9 years.
All right, Brian, what about 9 years for one player? You guys are normally very prudent about those sort of things. How did you justify, how did you get and say, hey, it's all right, we'll do 9 years?
I don't know if it's ever all right. It's an enormous, obviously, investment and a high risk to take. There's no question about it. We looked at it, with our, obviously, pro scouting and our analytics team, and I got a lot of people that are really smart and help guide me, and I just think it was a recognition because of age, and opportunity of a unique, individual that's entering free agency, no different than years gone by when it was CC Sabathia's turn or prior to that maybe Mike Messina's turn. You know, it's a rare opportunity when players like this enter the free agent market, so, it's never easy to wade in these type of waters, and certainly this historic contract is new, and we'll get judged, one way or the other on the ultimate outcome of it. But we felt that it was an investment and a risk that we were willing to take, because the opportunity, to improve our franchise and give our team and our fans a chance, was something we're willing to do clearly.
On Wednesday, news broke that the Milwaukee Brewers agreed to terms with Eric Sogard, second baseman, to a one-year, $4.5 million deal. And good news from out in Arizona. Terry Francona's stolen World Series rings have been recovered. Pronounced Pima County in Arizona. Sheriff's Department said in a release Tuesday that Francona's stolen Red Sox 2004 and 2007 World Series title rings had been purchased by a Phoenix sports memorabilia store. They were initially reported as stolen on November 7th. Let's get to it. Tyler Kepner covers baseball for the New York Times. And Tyler, of course, the author of a book that came out early this year. And Tyler, it's a holiday season, so it's always a good time for a book plug. What you got?
Yeah, thanks, Buster. It was a real labor of love for me for 3 or 4 years. It's called K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. And really, I just explore the mysteries of the slider, the knuckleball, the changeup, the fastball, all of them. Talked to 22 Hall of Fame pitchers and 300 people overall. And it came out in April, but it's obviously really timeless. And I think any baseball fan in your life would love it under the Christmas tree.
What was the coolest bit of feedback you got from somebody in the game after the book came out?
Well, it's funny, I got a call from Oral Hershiser because I had given him, he's in the book, and I had given him an early review copy, and he sort of paged through it and said some nice words for the back cover. But he said, honestly, he had put it in a travel bag, and after he had given the little blurb, he just sort of left it there, and then he was on a cross-country flight, and he used that travel bag later, and he's like, so I picked it up again, and I read it cover to cover. It was amazing. It was really, you captured, you taught me so many things about these pitches and stuff that I never knew. And I'm like, man, if I could tell Oral Hershiser some things he didn't know through my research, I must have been all right. And that was the biggest thing, Buster, because, we know, like, if you and I see a depiction of the media in a movie or a TV show, and it doesn't ring true, then it kind of loses all credibility. It's not like you have to be in the media to write about the media, but it's got to ring true to people in it. And so I felt like I'm not a pro pitcher, right? Obviously, but I can still write about it as long as I do enough research and talk to enough people to where it's accurate. And so when someone like Oral Hershiser or Zach Britton or some other people who read it tell me that I got it right, and that it rang true to them, that was really rewarding, because the whole process, I was like, you know what, I just don't want to write something that if a professional pitcher reads it, he'll say, you know what, this doesn't ring true to me. This isn't what it's all about.
That's really cool. That's so neat that you got that call from Oral, who I worked with on Sunday Night Baseball. And I love his enthusiasm for the game, and that's cool that you were on the other end of that. So congratulations on that. Yesterday, we just heard from Gerrit Cole in his press conference. And I got to tell you, my first reaction to that press conference yesterday, Tyler, and I was curious about your opinion on this because you covered for the Yankees a long time. My first thought was, my God, the hair thing. Really? He's got a shave. It feels so stupid and outdated. Where do you stand on that?
That doesn't bother me that much, really. I've come around on it. I mean, if I had a beard and loved having a beard, I wouldn't like it. And it's funny, man, because you see these guys in the off season, and all of them have beards. And as soon as they leave the Yankees, they have beards again. But I think it's okay to have one team that's kind of an outlier. If it was multiple teams, it would seem a little silly. But to me, it's like it's one thing that makes the Yankees distinctive. And I think that's all right. I just like the variety and the fact that it's one of those fun little baseball quirks. It doesn't bother me. I kind of find it charming in a way.
So after he pulled out that sign yesterday that he held up at the 2001 World Series, after hearing his excitement yesterday, I kind of wonder if the conversation behind the scenes at the beginning of the Gerrit Cole's free agency process was, you know, Scott, as in Scott Boras's agent, I want to sign with the Yankees in the end, but go do your thing and try to push the market where it's going to go. It really feels like that all along he wanted to pitch for the Yankees. What was your take?
Yeah, that was my thought. And, you know, it's just a little thing, but I happened to be standing in the Astros dugout during the Old Timers Day festivities, because the Astros were in town for Old Timers Day. And it was just when the players were milling around on the field and starting to be announced. And Gerrit Cole was so excited at that day just to be watching it, to be there for Old Timers Day. He was bouncing around giddily in the dugout. He spotted Chris Chambliss, and he said, "A UCLA Yankee, I got to meet this guy." So he ran over and met Chris Chambliss. It was just a small thing, but it showed me that all the stuff we'd heard about him being a Yankee fan was pretty genuine. And it was always going to come down to the biggest offer, but I think you're right. You know, you instruct your agent, "Hey, this is where I want to be. Now go do your thing and make it happen." And he did.
Yeah, and he gets the biggest contract ever for a starting pitcher. I feel like, Tyler, this is the best team in baseball on paper since those late 90 Yankee teams. The most complete team. When you talk about the Yankees bullpen, when you talk about their lineup, when you talk about a rotation that without Gerrit Cole, you know, is okay. But when you have Gerrit Cole at the front, it suddenly looks very different. You buying? You endorsing? Do you agree?
I agree. I had a scout tell me that last night, and I agree with it totally, because it's not just Gerrit Cole they're adding. You have to assume that they'll have Giancarlo Stanton and Luis Severino and Miguel Andujar too. So those are three guys they basically didn't have all season, who are potentially high impact guys. And so you're adding four guys, and I'll include Andujar in there because, you know, he had a really good rookie year. Four guys, basically, who you would expect to be healthy, who they didn't have last year. And they already won 100 games. So, I mean, when they get in the postseason, the strikeout thing worries me a little bit. But let's face it, they took the number one strikeout pitcher in baseball off their number one rival, the Astros, the team that's knocked them out three of the last 5 years. And that's a big swing right there. I mean, the Astros will bring back Lance McCullers, and they'll, you know, the Astros are always smart. They always figure things out. But Verlander and Greinke are 36, and they're coming off a long October and everything. The Yankees are the best team in baseball. I think there's no question about it.
Last week at the winter meetings, Major League Baseball held a press conference, and they had on a panel all the experts who were involved in the research of the baseball and the question about whether or not it was juiced. And there's a question that's been hanging over baseball all year long. Did baseball intentionally have the baseballs juiced? What was your takeaway after hearing all those voices that day?
Yeah, I wrote about that. It'd have to be a pretty widespread conspiracy, you know, for baseball to actually juice the balls. But it does seem, I can't get over the fact that it changed so suddenly. I can buy that there's less drag on the ball, that they don't know exactly why, but they have some theories, and the seam height accounts for 35% of it and all that stuff. But I still can't get a good answer on why it happened so quickly. Like, you would think a change would be, you know, in hitters' patterns and any changes in the ball because of the natural materials they use, you'd think it would be more gradual. But it was just 2014 where the ball seemed dead. And then second half of 15 and certainly into 16, it really started jumping. So that's where I can't get a great answer, and they don't really have one. But I guess at least we have some on-the-record scientific documentation as far as it'll go. They do admit there's things they don't know and that they haven't been able to measure yet. So at least they're not saying it's 100% definitive, but, you know, they put a lot of really smart minds with really good credentials up there on that panel, including former major league pitcher Chris Young, who works in the commissioner's office, who's the only one up there who actually had held a ball in his hands and thrown it. in a major league game. So it's an impressive panel. And I guess, Buster, though, it's the question is, like, if you're an executive, what do you do in your game planning? Like, all these guys who hit 20 home runs now, can you count on them to keep doing that if the ball behaves like this? Or can you expect the ball to be de-juiced? I don't think so, but there is some thought that maybe the ball will behave differently next year and we won't see quite as much power. So it's kind of an open question. But, I applaud them for at least taking the step and trying to publicly address this issue.
You're right. It's a real quandary for the individual teams when they're evaluating players about what they can expect them to be next year. I also think the harder, maybe the more difficult quandary would be for the head of the union leadership. Like, what are you advocating for?
Right.
You got half your constituency are pitchers and half are hitters. And you can't really lobby one way or the other. I mean, we heard Justin Verlander's opinion last summer, how he felt like it was a joke. And I know that there were a lot of position players, even some pitchers who weren't happy that Verlander was so outspoken. So I'm going to be fascinated to see what we see in the baseball at the beginning of 2020, especially after a postseason in which it felt like the baseball wasn't flying quite as much. Speaking of investigations, what do you think is going to happen in the Astros investigation? Because I know you wrote about that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I had heard earlier that they really wanted it to be wrapped up pretty quickly, but the more they sniffed around, the more they found to investigate, and the deeper they decided to make it go. So they've been doing a lot of research and interviews on this. 76,000 emails they talked about. I followed up with somebody who said, yeah, they got all the Astros emails. So what they had to do was try to find a filter to get the specific kinds of emails they were looking for, and figure that out. So they've been reaching out all over the place, and I think it has to be pretty severe. And I think it's one of those situations where, because there is such obvious and compelling visual evidence, they really have to do something. That's what you see all the time, it feels like. When people can connect something visual to the problem, then they can't really deny it anymore. So there has to be some kind of severe punishment. And from everything I understand and that's been written about, they're really targeting the leadership more than anything else. So that, to me, would mean Jeff Luhnow and T.J. Hinch and the people in Jeff's front office there. So I would imagine there would be some suspensions as well as the loss of draft picks and fines and everything. I love that baseball does not go through the charade like college sports does of vacating championships. I mean, that's ridiculous. The Astros won those games. We all saw it. And that's that. But, I'd be surprised if there were not some serious repercussions on this, just because we can all see and hear exactly what happened, and Mike Fiers confirmed it. So that's pretty compelling.
Last one before you go. In your piece, you tapped into what I've certainly felt has been this growing, seething anger among folks with other teams in your conversation with Dave Roberts, where Dave was asked, I don't know if you asked him or somebody else asked him about, when he looks back at the 2017 World Series when they were beaten in seven games by the Astros, it feels like he has already started asking questions about certain moments. That's the feedback that I've got from other people too, that, okay, you can say the Astros broke the rules, but in every case, if they had success because of that, there were folks on the other side of that who suffered the ramifications.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, think about this Dodgers run they've been on. Seven straight division championships, never been able to get over the hump. They keep hearing about 1988 over and over out there. They've done a lot of things right in that organization without a flag to fly for it. And that affects legacies. You know, you think about how differently we view teams and players that have won championships, even just one. The difference between zero championships to one is just astronomical in terms of your legacy. So, that's the stuff that you can't get back. And the Astros' accomplishments are, probably always going to be questioned. That really complicates the whole legacy. But it still doesn't give the Dodgers that title. And when you think back to that fifth game of that World Series, one of the weirdest, craziest games I've ever seen, that 13-12 or whatever it was, extra inning, you know, just ridiculous game where Clayton Kershaw is there with a 4-run lead and the chance to go up 3-2 in the series. If he gets the win there, he's probably the World Series MVP. They go back to LA and win it. But instead, he coughs it up. They come back. They cough it up again. I mean, it was just crazy. And I don't know if they were stealing signs that day. It was so loud in the ballpark. But all this stuff makes you wonder. And it really affects the way we think about this great Dodgers run.
100%. All right, Tyler. Thanks for doing this. Happy New Year to you and your family.
All right. You too, Buster.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul Amichitti. He's a honcho on the show Get Up. He tells us he's the head honcho. He's also a big baseball nerd, and we love having him on the show. His favorite team is the Philadelphia Phillies. And so, Hembo, in honor of you, in this last podcast of 2019, we're going to go all NL East
Woo-hoo.
Today. So we'll
Let's
start.
Go.
Nice. So we'll start with this. Give us your assessment of the Phillies and their offseason work so far and something that maybe is a concern for you.
I've been largely pleased with what the Phillies have done so far this offseason. I thought they paid an arm and a leg for Zach Wheeler, who has really never had a great season. That's obviously dominated the conversation, but I think the perhaps much more significant decision they made is to bring in D.D. Gregorius. Now, I operate under the opinion that there is really no such thing as a bad one-year deal, and especially in this case, D.D. Gregorius legitimately makes the Phillies better at three positions. So last season, the Phillies ranked 21st in infield defense. 2 years ago, they ranked 25th. And given their decision to allow Franco to walk the third baseman, and as well as non-tender Cesar Hernandez, the Phillies will have the opportunity to play Scott Kingery every day at a position, probably at third base or a second. Either way, he's going to be a plus defender in that spot. And we can finally move Gene Segura off a shortstop because I think it's fairly obvious that he's not that anymore either. So the Phillies are seemingly trying to get younger, more athletic, and better on defense. And I think the addition of D.D. Gregorius will have a ripple effect on the rest of the roster that we haven't quite discussed. And as you recall, in the Phillies' heyday, this was a really good defensive team in the infield with Utley and Rollins up the middle. They won the World Series in 2008 with Pedro Feliz as their third baseman. He was an outstanding defender there too. And in such a small, hitter-friendly ballpark, it adds extraordinary value. The Phillies can gobble up ground balls, and they just have not done that well the last 2 years. I think the addition of Gregorius makes a considerable difference in that respect.
What do you think of the offseason work of the New York Mets?
Well, I think the most significant news that came out of their camp this year is probably has to do with this offseason, probably has to do with the ownership. But I actually think that the Porcello and Waka decisions are fairly shrewd ones. They're, like I said, I don't really ever have a problem with one-year contracts, and you're buying low on two pitchers that have performed fairly well. But I think the Mets, given their inability to spend bigger, I think is more of a reflection on some past decisions that they've made, which I think, frankly, is a cautionary tale for pretty much everyone. Right now, this team is projected to have a competitive balance tax payroll of about $196 million, which is not too far from the threshold, which is pretty wild considering the holes they have in that roster. But, you know, when you're paying Cano and you're paying Lowry and you're paying Familia all this money, I think it's a cautionary tale because Brody came in last year guns a-blazing, right? He's trying to kowtow to ownership to make this team win now right away. And they're still sort of hanging on in this purgatory, which I think is a very bad place to be, frankly, in Major League Baseball these days, at least. And I think the decisions that they made last offseason, I think those ripple effects are still being felt and probably will for quite some time.
I'm fascinated about what they'll do with Steven Matz. Mm. If they essentially try to turn him into some version of a Josh Hader in the bullpen, you know, but if you look at the injury histories of Michael Wacha and you consider that Rick Porcello has been a starter his whole career and the way they're paying him, I can't imagine they would move him to the bullpen. They've got six starters for five spots. So Matz is going to be an interesting guy in spring training for me. Alex Anthopoulos, the general manager of the Braves, has talked about how he wants to add a middle-of-the-order bat. They're in conversations on Josh Donaldson. How acute is that need without Donaldson in it?
I don't think they need Josh Donaldson, frankly. Well, first of all, the top three hitters in that order are arguably, at least, the best collection in Major League Baseball. And I think that goes a long way, especially in the National League. Even if you have a lineup that you fill out 4 through 8 with a handful of league average guys, which is
about what they'll be, I think. The Braves offense will still be considerably above average. I'm also a believer in Austin Riley, and I know you are too, at least to an extent. Now, his strikeout to walk ratio last year, 108-16, is ugly, but the minor league track record is fairly good in terms of his pitch recognition, and I expect that he will continue to develop. The Braves seemingly get out in front of this Josh Donaldson decision by loading up on bullpen arms in addition to signing Cole Hamels and Travis d'Arnaud. I think the way they've handled their offseason is probably the best, actually, of any team in the National League East. I don't think they need Josh Donaldson to win the division again next year, and it seems to me, at least, that financially they've sort of created an opportunity for themselves to get ahead of the possibility that they won't bring him back. My expectation is that they won't, and frankly, I don't think they need to.
The Washington Nationals will try to become the first team since the 2000 Yankees to repeat as World Series champions in Major League Baseball. They lose Anthony Rendon. They keep Steven Strasburg. What's your take on the Nationals lineup without Rendon?
Well, this team needs Josh Donaldson or potentially Chris Bryant more than probably any team in this division, actually, at least in my judgment. The Braves have a lineup in place that I think can withstand not being able to add one of those guys. But the margin for error for the Nationals, I think, is considerably less. We talked last week on the podcast that they essentially chose Steven Strasburg over their best everyday position player, which is sort of a bizarre move. And again, this team didn't win their division last year, and was six outs away from not even advancing past the wild card game. So it's easy to remember this team as being some sort of juggernaut, but in reality, they really were not. They're the oldest team in baseball last season, so you really have to capitalize on this window that they have. I'm a big fan of the 22-year-old shortstop third baseman Carter Kieboom. I think he can play, but I'm not sure he's anywhere close to Anthony Rendon right now. I would be willing to package Kieboom and a couple other prospects potentially in a trade for Bryant. I think Josh Donaldson's a pretty nice consolation prize, but this is a win-now team, and in a hyper-competitive National League East, I think they should keep their foot on the gas, and given the way that they've built this thing, they have a lot less time to win another one than, say, the Braves do.
It's been very interesting with the Marlins this offseason. The most recent acquisition that they had, the signing of Matt Kemp, to a minor league deal, and they've added a lot of veterans this winter. And as I've seen that, I kind of wondered, okay, what's going on there? Because they, you know, like a lot of teams in recent years, they made the decision to tank. They traded Yelich and Stanton and a lot of the guys in what was a really good lineup as they rebuilt, and they cut down their payroll. And then it feels like this offseason they're back to adding veterans, which I don't understand. It feels like they should go all one way or all the other. And we saw, you know, the last couple of years, how the Padres have been increasingly impatient with the pace of their rebuild. That's what it feels like is happening with the Marlins.
I think that the Padres are a bad comparison for the Marlins, though, because the Padres' financial commitments to those veterans was considerably more. The Marlins, yeah. the Marlins, so long, I don't view this as a deviation from their plan. I think that this is a case of that my opinion is that Derek Jeter looks at this thing. We've drawn fewer than a million fans over the last two seasons. He obviously comes from a school of thought where he is obviously obsessed with winning and used to it. So I'd imagine it pains him to watch a mostly empty stadium of fans watch losing baseball every single night. And so long as you're not taking away reps from young players within your system or organization that otherwise would have the chance, to me signing, you know, VR and Aguilar and those types of players only really serves as a band-aid or a patch to provide some semblance of credibility for a franchise that right now just has none. So while I think the Padres did deviate from their plan in that sense in investing so much money in those veterans, I think the Marlins have sort of done the opposite. I really have no issue signing a bunch of veterans, and there's also some level of, it's hard to quantify, but intrinsic value in having a couple veterans in the lineup every day that, because in some sense, there's really no one on that club that's going to be a part of the next good team they have that have ever had any success previously or even have that much, coaching from veterans like it. So I'm not sure, that's not really something that you can quantify, but there is some value in that. Like Jonathan Villar will immediately be their best player, you know, and given the fact that they're in a similar position as the Orioles, I actually sort of tip my cap to Jeter in that front office for being willing to not, you know, blatantly tank when obviously everyone else seems to think that they should be.
As of today, I would pick the Braves to win this division. What about you?
I'd pick the Braves to win this division. They might be on a run here where they might do something similar to what they, you know, went on in the 90s. It wouldn't stun me if they did so.
Keeping all that pitching together. All right, Hembo, Happy New Year to you.
Same to you, boys.
It's time for some inside heat on Baseball Tonight.
Alex Bear covers the Red Sox, covers baseball for the Boston Globe. He's also the author of a new book this year, Homegrown. Alex, as Tyler did, give us a book plug.
I I spent a number of years trying to figure out, kind of taking a 360-degree survey, or as close as I could get to it, of the Red Sox and what happened from 2011 to 2018 in order to create a homegrown championship core. And it wasn't just a story of getting better. It was a story of how an organization struggles to achieve its plans in a way that has, I hope, a kind of timelessness, while also connecting with a pretty special group of players and the dynamics between them that help them ultimately achieve something very good, but that ultimately isn't necessarily proving sustainable moving forward.
Yeah, and that 2018 Red Sox championship team is arguably the best in the franchise's history. But as you know, they've cycled off of that now, and they're in the process of restructuring as they move forward. And, man, Alex, I know you, in your position in covering this team, you have to follow all the headlines or try to lead the headlines on this. They're generating a lot of headlines, and I want you to help us separate between what's real and maybe what's a little bit overstated. Where do they stand right now in the process of talking with other teams about Mookie Betts?
I think that they're just in they're still kind of in the general exploration stage. Nothing is front burner for them. They are willing to listen on anyone, as they probably should at a time when they're trying to figure out how they're going to navigate the dread luxury tax iceberg. And so they'll listen on anyone, because if they're able to get, the kind of franchise changing talent back that would justify that move, well, they would be remiss not to listen to that. But I think it still remains their preference to see if they can create room to address roster needs and get under the CBT threshold by dealing from elsewhere on the roster, particularly starting pitchers and maybe someone like Jackie Bradley Jr. But you know, they're in listening phase, and they're exploring a lot of whatever possibilities are out there. They want to know about them so that ultimately they can pick a direction of, okay, this is the guy, or these are the guys we have to trade, and now we can go about setting the rest of the roster.
At the beginning of the offseason, I had a general manager say to me about all the teams that were looking to add starting pitching. His observation was, I don't know where they're going to find it. Like, in his view, there weren't a lot of volume of options for those teams to look through, which could work in favor of a team like the Red Sox, who are dangling someone like a David Price, a Nathan Eovaldi, now that some of the bigger names, the Gerrit Coles, the Zach Wheelers, Steven Strasburg, have come off the board. Just it feels like around the edge, like they have more traction on their conversations around Price. What have you heard?
Well, I think that they'd like to have more traction, quite frankly, with David Price, because that's one that, you know, he's taking up a large part of the payroll for the next few years at a time when he's probably in a stage of decline in terms of stuff. As you know, he's kind of masterful in terms of his ability to craft as a pitcher. He's moved well beyond the pure power pitcher phase of his career, but he's really, really good in terms of being able to command a mix in order to remain effective even in a decline phase. But that said, yeah, I think that they're exploring that option. I'm not sure if that's where they're getting the most traction. I do think that there remain health concerns related to David Price. If you look at the volume of innings he's thrown over the last few years, he's averaged fewer than 120 innings a year over the last three. So I think that it's an imperfect time to be marketing him. But I do think that you're right that they've been waiting for a lot of these names to come off the board. And Keiko and Ryu still remain on the board. There are still some options out there. But I think that they've been patient in hopes of finding the time when the aisles are a little bit, when all of the shopping aisles are a little bit like threadbare or picked over, in order to say, okay, you missed out on X, Y, and Z. Now we have these guys as alternatives that look a little bit better.
I've been told by agents in the last 48 hours that the two most desperate teams in terms of needing starting pitching right now are the Chicago White Sox and the Minnesota Twins. I think the Angels as well probably could fit into that category. Alex, I felt like when the Yankees signed Gerrit Cole and created this absolute super team with his lineup that led the majors in runs last year, with his strong bullpen, and with Gerrit Cole now as the ace, in some ways it actually might serve the Red Sox purposes, make it easier for them to go through this restructuring. Agree or no?
Partially agree. We saw it before a little bit to an extent in the offseason when the Yankees signed both CeCe Sabathia and Mark Teixeira and the Red Sox responded by kind of pulling back a little bit that offseason and going for and acquiring guys like John Smoltz and Brad Penny as buy-low opportunities meant to round out roster depth. Granted, they weren't subtracting at that time. They weren't looking to deal away a player who had been a key contributor to a championship team. But, I think that it makes I don't think the Red Sox are under any illusions. The Yankees should be really, really good next year and are going to be easily the favorites in the AL East. But the Red Sox aren't in a position where they can ever punt on a season. It's one of the reasons why a long-term build for teams like the Red Sox and the Yankees can be so challenging, because they can't just say, well, you know what? This is the year that we're just going to cede it to our rivals and say that, you know, everything's okay. That doesn't go over very well when you're trying to, you know, when you're trying to pack in 95 to 98% capacity in a ballpark on a night after night basis. So I think that it probably doesn't alter a lot about what the Red Sox are looking at in terms of their roster building, but I do think that it means that they face a pretty steep grade in 2020.
Now, what I've heard from other teams is, when you mentioned the idea of trading a David Price or an Eovaldi, other teams seem to be eyeing Andrew Benintendi to some degree. What's their perspective on whether or not they'd even think about putting him in a contract to help move a big contract?
Never say never, but I think that they're really, I think part of the reason why they aren't exactly moving quickly on the trade market is because they don't want to do that. They don't want to move a guy who's young, controllable, at this point relatively inexpensive, having to address a hole. If the idea is to create sustainability moving forward, then that's not just payroll, that's talent as well. And selling low on Andrew Benintendi following this past season is a hard one for them to swallow. They'd have to get some pretty good major league ready, you know, talent back in order to justify a trade that looked like that. They, you know, they're of the mind that they're offering assets in their pitchers who in their own right should be able to command talent. I'm not sure how realistic that is. We saw what the Corey Kluber trade looked like. And prices in, you know, Price and the Eovaldi come with more risk than that. But I think that they would really like to avoid doing that, which is no shock, right? Like, you don't want to have to, you hate when you have to give up talent, especially young talent, just in an effort to move payroll. That's a tough one for an organization.
All right. Alex's new book, again, is called Homegrown. He actually did a podcast, extensive podcast interview with Keith Law back on August 7th for anyone who wants to listen to that. And I would encourage you to go and get the book. It's absolutely terrific. Alex, thanks for doing this.
I really appreciate it. Buster, always a pleasure to be on. Hope you have a great, great holiday season.
Bleacher Tweets.
Rita Wong is a crazy Twins fan who's known on Twitter as Rena Benina, and she helps us out with Bleacher Tweets. And Rena, good to talk with you again. Before we get started, just wanted to ask you about your new writing gig. You're in the industry.
I'm in the industry. I'm one of you. Finally.
So tell me about it.
Yeah, so I am a contributor to the Twins Daily. So I basically put together all of my crazy ideas and things that I come up with outside of this podcast and in my day-to-day life, finally can throw it on paper for readers to read. And if you've never heard of the Twins Daily, please check it out. It's a super awesome, wonderful group of equally, if not more, passionate Twins fans, all independent writers across the world, really, and great content. So, yeah, it's been super, super fun so far.
Buster, remember?
Now, as you were talking, no. Troy, let me talk. As you were talking, Troy tried to get in my ear because he wanted to, you know, throw out something. But I think what he really wanted to do is change the subject because he knows what's coming next, which is another conversation about the friend zone. Because Troy has been sucked back into that like a vortex on the edge of the whirlpool. Troy, can you please explain?
Well, I may have recently had to spend the night over at this girl's house, and let me just say, I made it known that I was there.
So, Rena, he basically, what he did was ignore your advice to create some space.
My, oh my. Is this safe for work? Is this podcast still safe for work?
Well, when he referenced spend the night, I think he literally meant sleep on the floor.
Sleep
on the floor someplace.
Okay, just making sure. This is a family show, Troy.
Oh, I know.
Well, you know, if you're going to ignore my advice, I do appreciate that you just completely obliterated it like a polar vortex. I mean, if you're going to not ignore her, you might as well just go for the jugular at this point. So,
wow.
I love it.
Boy, oh boy. Yeah, Troy's all fired up. He's going to be excited because I remember the last time when we got done talking with you about this topic, Rena, he immediately was like, you know what? I'm going to take Rena's advice. And then he actually executed that for a day or two. Right, Troy?
Right. To change the subject again, what I wanted to say was, remember how you were saying that ESPN is kind of like a training ground for managers in baseball? I kind of feel like the Baseball Tonight podcast, the Bleacher Tweeter specifically, we got Jason Amico, we've got Rena, Landon Jobs. I think Bleacher Tweets also a little spring for the next step.
I would agree with that 100%. All right, let's get the Bleacher Tweets, Rena.
Absolutely. Yeah, let's kick things off then with Rick Gabler at Rick_Gabler. Hey, Buster, how many titles does the evil empire Yankees have to win to feel justified in their spending? 9 years and $324 million seems to require more than just one to me.
Interesting question. Think back to the days that when the Yankees signed C.C. Sabathia, Mark Teixeira, and A.J. Burnett. If you had told Yankee fans at that point, after spending almost $500 million on those three players, would they have been happy with just one championship, which is what they got? I think generally speaking, the answer would be no. So it's a fair question. I'd say two. What about you, Rena?
Yeah, I would say somewhere between two and four, based on how many they won in the 2000s and the decade before. And why not nine at this point?
Oh, wow. Well, I said when they signed him that really on paper, this is the most complete team that I've seen in baseball since the late 90s. I mean, it really is a complete team that looks like it's going to be absolutely dominant. And as one executive said to me, it's not a question of whether or not the Yankees can win it. The question is who's going to beat them. So we'll see how that plays out. All right.
Yeah, they will be scary. And if they play my Twins again next year in the postseason, I will not be using my vacation to attend those games. Next, we've got Brian Simpson at BSimp120274. Hey, Buster, seeing the contracts Anthony Rendon and last year for Nolan Arenado, did my Padres totally overspend for Manny Machado? And just as a reminder to the listeners, Machado signed a 10-year, $300 million contract with the Padres.
I think they did, and I felt they did at the time. It's interesting, we just saw the Yankees execute the largest contract ever for a pitcher. If you remember, the Yankees' comfort level when they were talking to Machado was like around $200 million, which was significantly less. The initial offer and the bidding, big offer among the teams that were serious about Machado was $175 million by the White Sox. And then the Padres got very emotional about it. They kind of jumped in at the end, and they wound up bidding up, and the White Sox wound up bidding up. But, yeah, I didn't think it was a good fit for the Padres because of their market size and their budget size, and I think it's only going to continue to be a problem as we move forward.
Yeah, sorry, Brian. Next, we've got Mitchell at Tigers of Detroit. The Dodgers have been quiet this offseason. Do you see them trying to make a splash via trade or just add a few smaller pieces via free agency?
It feels like you have one of those situations where there's so much chatter beneath the surface about the Dodgers talking about Mookie Betts, the Dodgers talking about Francisco Lindor, the Dodgers exploring this, they're exploring that. I think they are going to do something big before we get to spring training.
How do you feel about the rumors then surrounding Gavin Lux as a bargaining chip, even though that's not usually the way that the Dodgers like to do it? They don't like to trade away their top prospects.
100%. And you nailed it, Rena. That's exactly the first thing that pops to mind when you hear, you know, they're talking about Betts. They're talking about Lindor. Okay, who's the number one prospect that they're going to give up? Because part of the reason why the Dodgers have had such sustained success in recent years is they always keep their best guys. They kept Corey Seager. They kept Cody Bellinger. They've kept Lux. They've kept Will Smith. And that's why I have doubts about whether or not they'll be the team that executes a deal for Lindor.
Yeah, we'll see where it goes with the Dodgers. Next, we've got Corey Rukert at CoreyR_12. Hey, Buster, if the Reds, fingers crossed, sign a Nick Castellanos or a Marcell Ozuna, is that enough to be the NL Central favorites when combined with the pitching staff?
I don't think favorites per se, but I do think they're going to be in the mix. You know, if things go right, for example, if Joey Votto has a bounce-back year – You know, some of their pitchers come through next season. Nick Senzel takes a step forward. Yeah, I think they absolutely could be in the mix because I don't see right now that there's this absolute juggernaut dominant team in the Central in the way that we've seen in the past with the Cubs and the Cardinals.
If you were to bet just an acre of the family farm, would you still have it on the Cubs in the Central?
I don't know if I'm comfortable betting any part of the family farm on any team in the Central because we know the Brewers are doing what the Brewers do, and they had to take a step back this offseason in managing payroll. We haven't seen the Cardinals go out and make a big acquisition. I don't think they're going to have that moment this winter where they're going to bring in a big middle-of-the-order type hitter or superstar pitcher. The Cubs are restructuring. It's more likely that they're going to unload someone like a Chris Bryant. So, Rena, I'm not going to bet any part of the farm in any of the five teams.
Not even a bucket. So the family farm stays intact for the NL Central for next year. Lastly, we've got Ben at Chief Seats number one with a really interesting question, a little out of left field. Assuming another few years of similar production with great defense and not so great offensive numbers, is Andrelton Simmons a viable Hall of Fame candidate?
You know, Ben, when I first saw your question, I thought it was crazy, and I thought I was going to ask Rena just not to address it. And then I looked up some numbers. I talked in recent weeks about the effect of Harold Baines' election last year. Think about this. To this point, in part because of his defensive dominance, Andrelton Simmons' career WAR is at 36.9. 36.9, and he's 30 years old. Harold Baines' career WAR 38.7. So he's almost matched him because of how good Simmons has been on defense. Now, I would say this. Omar Vizquel is currently a candidate for the Hall of Fame. He has not been close to election. I don't think Simmons gets in unless Omar Vizquel gets in. Rena, what do you think?
I would agree. And I had to ruminate on this one a little bit and just reading the question right away this morning at 6 a.m, I thought, Ben, you were crazy. And why would you even think of something like this? But I think that after ruminating a little bit more and potentially digging into the numbers, I would agree with you, Buster.
Yeah, it's actually, I think, closer than what people would think because Simmons has been that good on defense. And Harold Baines didn't play defense. So, we'll see where it goes from here. All right, Rena, thanks for doing this. Happy holidays to you.
Thank you for having me. And Troy, keep us posted, but stay out of the vortex.
All right. Happy holidays to everyone as well. All of our listeners will be talking with you in the new year. My thanks today to Tyler and to Alex and Arena and to Troy, who produces podcasts every day during the course of the season and when we have this off-season podcast. And thanks to Hembo, too. Have a great New Year's, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.